This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We're meeting Wednesday, January 28, 1987, at 5 p.m. in Hearing Room 343. This will be a public hearing on Senate Bill 323. Today we will be hearing from Jim Gardner, Seals, John Hart, Paul Fortino, John Holmes, Tom Bessonet, John Powell, and Jack Monroe.
Well, it's 5.07 p.m. The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order 7 minutes late. And I notice Senator Brockman is present, and Senator Hill is present. Senator Cohn is excused. Senator Brenneman is excused. And I can't help but make the observation from looking at the people in the audience and the committee members who are here that the subject of great concern to everybody does not appear to be of great moment to either the committee members or the general public at this point in time. But, there are two reasons for that in the chair's opinion. Reason number one is because there has been a terrific drop-off since about a year ago in terms of whether this is a matter of extreme urgency, or the other is that everybody that's involved has got his mind made up and no one's interested in hearing what the facts might be. But in any event, I am certain that when we get into work sessions that there will be more everybody present. So anyway, you've got the agenda now. Is I see the first name on the list here, and in case there's anybody that doesn't understand how we're doing this thing. Sorry, I just now started. No.
Yes.
Okay. Well, probably going to be pretty early because I don't see too much. The main nurse.
Yes, it does.
Pick a place.
Where do you like to go?
Senator, how are you?
Okay, now, Jim Gardner is the first name I've got on the list here. And if that's the same Jim Gardner that used to serve in the Senate and on this committee, I do recognize him, and he's not here, so we'll skip over him. And we have John Holmes and Peter Richter, who are here. You gentlemen going to appear together or separately?
Your Honor?
Seals means a representative from Seals and going to handle those.
Okay.
But I didn't.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all right. Come on up. Kip, are you just an observer when these people testify, or were you going to participate, or how are you going to work
these,
this?
We've arranged, Your Honor, for these people to testify on behalf of Seals, and as they will explain, also clarify where they're testifying on behalf of the Oregon Association Defense Council as well. So I will not be presenting additional testimony at this time on this particular issue.
All right. Why don't you give that to that charming young woman over there, and she'll distribute it.
Should have said which one.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Senator, I'm John Holmes. I'm a practicing lawyer in Portland. I've been a member of the Oregon State Bar and been in private practice for a little over 20 years. My practice is almost entirely in the area of the defense of civil litigation. I'm a member of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, and I'm on the board of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. For those who are lawyers, the differentiation of these organizations is usually clear. Our group consists of those lawyers in Oregon, and to become a member and to be a member, who devote a substantial amount of their practice to the defense of civil litigation, as contrasted with the Oregon Trial Lawyers, which is our counterpart association, which consists of those lawyers who represent plaintiffs in personal injury cases.
Who are you speaking for today now? Both groups?
I'm speaking with regard to sections 2 through 5 on punitive damages. I will give you the position of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, which is my personal position, but I will give you that. It's in writing, and I will give it to you in my testimony.
Now, let's see now. Help me out here a minute. CIELS is the coalition, I guess, right?
That's right.
And what's the full name of the coalition?
Coalition, the full name, as I understand it, is the Citizens Initiative for Equity in the Legal System. And it consists of, as I understand it, over 82 organizations that have been working in this area, and I can't tell you when they took up their work.
All right.
By way of background, last year, the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel adopted through its board a position in support of tort reform in Oregon. And the position as adopted by it was promulgated, I think it was last spring, in a statement of principles on tort litigation cost containment, which includes a position on punitive damages and includes a position on other things that are not relevant to this hearing, but that are relevant when dealing with the scope of the bill that you're dealing with, such as collateral source, joint and several liability, et cetera. With regard to the opinion of OADC, specifically with regard to punitive damages, our position, as set forth in our statement of principles, is that the doctrine should be abolished. We feel that in this area and in a couple of the other areas addressed, that there is an area that results in cost and occasionally results in damages that increase the overall cost of the system and are not reasonably related to providing reasonable compensation to the victims of tort. Generally, the situation with regard to punitive damages that our experience shows us is related to the problem is not in the fact that they are often awarded, they are not, but it is in the cost and expense that is incurred in the defense of the claims, and it is in the threat to the parties sued with regard to such claims. I have had punitive damages alleged in cases that I've handled and every year that I've been in practice, and once were they allowed as part of the verdict. And that was in the amount of $10,000. But I have seen allegations of punitive damages in many cases and have participated in the necessity of providing a defense of those cases and watched companies feel the pressure and the concern over these allegations against them. And the problem with the whole area is that we're talking about something that by definition is not compensatory. It is not to compensate. Now, getting down to the specific sections, sections 2 through 5 of SB 323, our problems are as follows. Section 2 provides that as a matter of public policy, a liability insurer shall not insure against punitive damages. Now, apparently, as I read that, apparently that is an expression that is geared toward the current concern about the cost of liability insurance, the current concern about these allegations, and it would appear to be a good faith attempt to do something in that regard. However, that intention, to my way of thinking, is misplaced for the following reason. Usually, punitive damages presently are not insured. And to understand how this happens, and it really relates to the type of experience we have in my business, is that what happens when you buy a policy of liability insurance, it usually has an exclusion for punitive damages or intentional acts or the type of things that would evoke a response of punitive damages, and you get sued in a broad-based complaint where they are alleged. The insurance company has the right and duty to control the defense, and say they hire me or they hire Mr. Richter, and we go to work, and at the same time they are obliged to write the insured, either an individual or a company, and say, we will defend you on everything, but if you have any verdict against you or judgment against you for punitive damages, we will not pay it. Now, at that point, and it gets a little confusing, and I don't think it's understood by the public, when we get appointed, even though we're paid by the insurance company, we then become the attorney for the party sued. So immediately, we're in a conflict because part of the problem that party being sued is insured and part is not. So then a letter goes out from the insurance company, and we call in the client also and talk about this. But the letter says, we will defend you under what is known as a reservation of rights. So you probably want to talk to your own attorney about this also. So then they go get an attorney, and that attorney usually does not defend the case but consults with us who are hired by the insurance companies, and naturally has concern about this uninsured exposure. So that's the current state of the law. So Section 2, to our way of thinking, doesn't address it. And we think that, frankly, the simple way to address it, and we don't think that it is going to cause any loss of damages to anybody that has a reasonable claim with regard to injury damages, is simply to abolish punitive damages. We have four states that have them abolished. The reasons stated for the use of them, such as deterrence and so forth, we don't see that the conduct is any changed in those states as it is here. We see that it can be used for leverage by a plaintiff's attorney. We see that it can be used as a hammer, but the expense that everyone goes through to attempt to collect something that is not compensatory is, to us, adding an expense that can be done away with to make the system more responsive and more reasonable in cost.
Well, let me ask you a couple questions on
sure.
that. The state of Washington is one of the four states in the country without punitive damages, right?
That's my understanding.
And the state of Washington apparently is has been confronted with the same type of liability insurance crisis that is happening here. So I assume that if there is or has been some crisis in the state of Washington, we can't lay it at the doorstep of punitive damages.
No question about that, Senator.
Right. Second question. The situation as it presently exists, which you have explained to the committee, is the same situation that has existed historically in Oregon. That is, we've had punitive damages. The insurance company doesn't insure against punitive damages as a general rule. Insurance company takes a case of the reservation of rights. Insurance company says if there's a verdict that includes punitive damages, we won't pay them. So that's all the same today as it's
always. That's right.
And then my last question for now. As we try to focus on whether any changes in the civil justice system will promote or tend to promote or help reduce the cost of insurance in this state. Do insurance defense lawyers try a case really basically very much different when there are punitive damages involved?
Yes. Absolutely.
Maybe you can help me on that, because I do...
There is no question that we spend more time and feel duty-bound to spend more time because of the increased exposure.
Well, you mean that...
Let me put it another way, Senator.
Okay.
We can spend, with reasonable justification, a lot more time defending a case with a prayer of $2 million than we can one with a prayer of $20,000. And we seem to be required to do it by the people who employ us, both the insurers and the self-insurers, self-insureds we represent.
So the fact that you might, as a defense lawyer, treat a case with punitive damages differently from one without, and therefore put in more time, would have a relationship because you are spending more hours and the insurance company that hires you is paying you more. And that's the expense that we're talking about, basically here.
That's part of it, but there also is the additional expense to the insured. The problem with tort reform, and it's a little difficult to discuss in a vacuum, it's difficult for me to hone in on punitives and try to give you my scope of the overall picture as to what would help, because we have other things in our package that you're dealing with that if we're not talking about them all together. The things that we attempted to adopt in our statement of principles by OEDC, we think that would help. We realize that across the country, and we realize that the plaintiff's attorneys who basically oppose tort reform have across the country, privately or publicly, or offered a different slant on it, basically asked the question, can you prove that this will lower liability insurance rates? And the answer, I think, if anybody is telling you the truth, the answer is no. But we can tell you some things about it. We can tell you about insurance capacity. We can tell you about some things of common sense. For example, you pay a premium on a $2 million building that costs you X number of dollars to insure that building. You pay a premium on a $200,000 house that costs X number of dollars to insure that house. We all know that your premium on the $200,000 house is less. So just like I can't tell you what the stock market did today or guess what it's going to do tomorrow, and I can't tell you the entire insurance thing, I can tell you that I've talked with people at Lloyd's of London who say that one of the reasons that they haven't been in the reinsurance market is because of all of the expense and the verdicts in America. And there is no question that when I got around to them quoting us a 750% increase on our legal malpractice excess coverage, and they say there's only a couple companies in the market, you understand this. But I'm not one to say that any one thing is a quick fix, Senator, and I'm not that naive. What I'm suggesting to you is that if we look as defense attorneys and try to be a reliable intellectual resource to you people, we can say that we think if you would do something in concert about the collateral source rule, about joint and several liability, and about punitive damages, we can see how you can help bring reasonable costs that we think should and have to, with the right amount of time, bring lower insurance rates.
Well, I want to go ahead, Senator Cohen.
Now, I just want to get a better understanding about how your part of the industry works in the sense of, I'm getting an inference that your charges or the costs of the defense are some percentage of the costs of the prayer. Is that?
No.
And I know you say no, it's all just, we just get paid by the hour by it like everybody else. I'm interested in how you do get paid and how those things break out based on the costs of the alleged amounts that are being requested, et cetera, so that I can get a better understanding of how the defense part of the industry operates.
I'll be glad to try, Senator. We do get paid on an hourly rate. We don't get paid on a contingent fee or on a percentage of the prayer. My point would be, and I think those lawyers that have tried injury cases from the defense viewpoint, whether for the insurance industry or otherwise, would understand that a client that employs you, when there is a prayer of $2 million, generally is faced with a plaintiff's attorney who is making a serious effort and is hiring experts and doing filing requests for production and doing these things that necessitate your response in spending more time. And so it gets back to the simple, prudent argument, would you, if it was your company that was sued for $200,000 and they were doing a good job of presenting the case against you and spending a lot of time, would you want to give a low budget to your attorneys and say, I don't want you to spend much time defending this, or would you say, $200,000 is a lot of money, I want you to spend more time on it? And it's that kind of thing that operates. For example, that I had, I'm involved in a toxic tort case that is pending that I have not thought that I had much exposure, but the plaintiff's attorney keeps pressing it and keeps filing requests for interrogatories and taking depositions, and I have to go to it. And the prayer is large. So because of that, and because of the exposure to my client, and because of the exposure to that insurance company, they want me to spend more time on it.
The reason that I'm probably taking more time with this point than I might take with others is because, I was the only member of this committee that sat on the task force, and I was very interested in this point because I've had a lot of personal involvement with cases involving punitive damages, and I have a real tough time understanding why the cost of insurance, where insurance does not cover punitive damages, should be very much different when you're representing an insured and there are punitive damages or there aren't. It seems to me that a lawyer is going to defend a case, I suppose, as one prosecutes a case, and that is to the best of your ability. I can't understand, I'm having difficulty figuring out why you'd be spending more time if there's a claim for punitive damages in the case.
Mr. Richter said he'd like to respond to that. Is that all right with the Senator?
Fine. Yeah. Anybody?
Senator Frey, in the example that Mr. Holmes used a minute ago, when you have a claim, say, against Senator Cohen, for example, she's sued in a lawsuit for $10,000 general damages, and there's a $1 million punitive damage claim. Her insurance coverage, for example, does not cover punitive damages. So Mr. Holmes is retained by her insurer to represent her on the $10,000 claim. He then tells Senator Cohen, the insurance coverage will not cover you for the $1 million punitive damage claim. Senator Cohen goes out and gets another lawyer to represent her on the punitive damage claim. That lawyer starts writing letters to Mr. Holmes saying, you better settle within that $10,000 compensatory claim, or we're going to sue the insurer for wrongful refusal to settle because of Senator Cohen's exposure. So what does that do to the settlement discussions that Mr. Holmes...
Could I ask, so then my lawyer that I've hired privately gets involved with the insurance company's lawyer, who also defending me, saying, you better do it.
That forces the settlement costs up. And there was a study done in Multnomah County in 1984 that indicates, it's a very small study, but it indicates that in cases where punitive damages are claimed, even though they don't go to trial, settlements are increased. Those cases settle more, and they settle for more money because punitive damages have become a blackmail in our legal system.
But then that's not necessarily, Mr. Chairman, why we ought to get rid of punitive damages just because the lawyers decide it's time to start blackmailing each other. I mean, there are other ways to deal with that, I hope.
Well, I agree with that. There are other ways, but I think this is a beginning. To eliminate.
I want to get into the other ways.
Okay.
We get through with all this whole package, and so I want to talk some more to you and to the other parties involved here. And I'm not really saying, I think we got to have some other.
I agree with that.
Improvements in process.
Absolutely.
Hey, Senator Hill, I have a question.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd like to move to the trial phase and understand what you said about settlements. Is it the jury that makes the ultimate decision on punitive damages?
Yes.
Okay, well, the heart of our legal system, at least to me, is a jury. Now, we put the people of this state have instituted the death penalty, which in a criminal area, I guess, translates into your multi-million-dollar suit. And the thing is that we literally put the lives of the life of a defendant on the line, and basically put it in the hands of the jury. And I guess, which is, of course, is a great deal of faith. And I guess I need to hear from you whether you believe that the juries, good people, tried and true, are really being excessive when they're making these awards, because that is the heart, and I think it may not be the best, but I think on the whole, we rely on it. I think it performs fairly well, and I guess I need to have some evidence that juries are really being unreasonable when someone appears before them and says, I've really been hurt extraordinarily badly, and are they really just abusing that charge that has been put to them?
Mr. Holmes or me? Or
well,
whichever.
First of all, Senator, I'm a believer in the jury system, and I think it should be maintained. And I am generally a believer in the wisdom of juries. There's no question but that juries make some mistakes. And we're talking about a couple things here. Insofar as you are talking about compensatory damages, I have a little less concern with what a jury might do than I do with damages that by their nature are not compensatory, but are to punish a wrongdoer. Now, the example that I gave you earlier, which is kind of a classic example about extra expense, the one case I've ever had that I tried where I was hit for punitive damages, the general damages were so low that we had offered and were willing to pay, the insurance company was willing to pay, and the insured wanted it settled for that. But we spent 3 days trying the case at the expense of the insurance company over the punitive damages. The punitive damages in that case were not excessive, but the point that I am making there is not so much of the jury system, but there is an added cost about a doctrine that I don't think fits in the compensatory scheme for people who are injured in the tort system.
Go ahead. I guess the point that I'm trying to make, and I think in most trials, unless it's just clear cut, I'm talking about in the criminal area now, unless it's clear cut, and it seldom is, the jury makes some decision about guilt or innocence. And I think, and I'm not a practicing attorney now, but I know that we don't know why juries decide why they do and what that interaction, what kind of interaction takes place, but yet we really do rely on that to really come out and be fair. And it's I think it's seldom certain, but we rely on a process that they will come to the right decision. And in regard to the expense, if you're talking about where someone has committed a serious crime, the jury death penalty cases are extremely expensive. And that was one of the things that I think everyone knew at the outset. But when something extremely, an extremely heinous crime has been accused, then the stakes are high. And I would say that in preparation for a criminal case, the preparation probably is going to be more extensive in that case. And I guess, and I don't see what's wrong with that. If you're trying to do justice, if a lot is at stake, then it will cost more. But if the goal is to really try to award someone who's been given an award to someone who has really been hurt badly, I guess I don't know, I don't see why we want to stop the jury from doing that.
All right. Let me just, I understand what you're talking about. The wisdom of the jury system is something that I generally believe in. But I would say that historically, We don't operate in a vacuum in these things, and we have had reasonable limitations on people's right to recover by statute in Oregon forever. For example, an action against a public entity. And I did some work for a major public entity a year ago who called me up in July and said, will you now represent us because we don't have insurance? But they have a limitation, basically, of $100,000 per person or $300,000. So they have a limitation. Now, does it make any sense that somebody, when they get run over by the city of Salem, can recover $100,000, or if they get run over by someone else, can recover $100 million? This, the reasonable, a reasonable level, and I'm not suggesting what that ought to be right now, but what I'm saying is that when we say that we don't think punitive damages is a useful part of the compensatory system, what we're saying is there is a background for taking a look at the system and making the type of changes to make it, attempt to make it responsive and still just and fair to the people that are injured.
One more, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be done.
If I may just briefly respond, Senator Hill, to your concern. I think we lawyers forget that the basis for punitive damages arose under English common law. Under English common law, there was no ability to recover for pain and suffering. And that's why the concept of punitive damages